Welcome to the Joseph Campbell Audio Collection. This talk is called Symbolism and the Individual. It's the third selection in the series entitled Mythology and the Individual. And now, Joseph Campbell.
The point I want to try to make tonight is a contrast between Oriental and Occidental concepts of the problem of the individual. My principal intention is to try to indicate to all here that the ideals of the West for the individual and for individual and freedom and so forth have no meaning whatsoever in the Oriental world, in the traditional Oriental world, and had better be revised, had better been reviewed in our thinking with reference to our ideals for the rest of the world. I want, on the other hand, to stress the fact that for the West, this is the great ideal, and it is what we represent and what we have to contribute to humanity in the way of a spiritual image. I draw the main division between Orient and Occident in terms of mythological and traditional symbolism in Iran, in Persia. This is, I would say, the watershed. Eastward of Iran, we have two great domains: the domain of India and its world, the domain of the Far East, essentially China and Japan. Westward of that domain, we have two divisions also: the division of the Levant, of the Near East, and the division of Europe. And these four domains, in the history of their symbolic traditions, are quite distinct in style, quite distinct in ideas. However, they do group into two orders of two: India and China on the one hand, the Levant and the West, and Europe on the other. These two great fields represent, in earlier days, dialogues between each of its divisions: India and the Far East in dialogue, Levant and Europe. The great, extraordinary thing that has happened in the contemporary world is that these two quite different spheres of humanity have been brought together and now are trying to speak to each other intelligibly so that they should understand each other and be able to live, so to say, in symphony or in counterpoint, not any one overpowering the other, since what we need really is this multiple discourse. The extraordinary thing to consider is that all four have sprung finally from one single root. Every one of these civilizations is based ultimately on the arts of agriculture and the domestication of cattle. And we know from archaeology now that this great transformation of humanity from the status of hunting and food collection to the status of food production and the building of big communities can be dated, and must be dated, about 6,000 B.C. in the Near East. So that it is actually from the Levant that the branches of this great tree of the four domains of civilization stem. In the earlier primitive societies, which are small, I think it can be said every individual controls the entire cultural inheritance. You have in a small hunting community a community of equivalent adults. Every adult is, in terms of that culture's notion, a total human being. The only divisions are in terms of sex and age groups. But every man, every woman, even every youngster controls what is necessary to control in order to be a total member of that society. However, with the emergence of the larger communities based on the arts of agriculture, which begin to appear very distinctly in the archaeological remains around 5000 BC, the antecedents are shortly earlier than that. By 4500 BC, there is a whole constellation of substantial villages in the Near East. By 3500 BC, they have begun to be rather large cities. It is at this time that a differentiation in the society begins to build up. There are specialists. There are craftsmen with specializations. There are priest castes. There are governing castes. And there are serving castes. You get a differentiation of the society. And the adult now is no longer in total control of the entire culture good. He is a part man. And one can see in the symbolism of this period the interest in trying to conceive of the relationship of part to whole. It is in the pottery designs of 4500 BC that the first geometrical organizations of a field occur. There is no such thing in earlier art. About 4500 BC, in the art of the Samarra and Halaf styles, we see very beautifully organized fields with disparate elements gathered so that they relate to a whole. And in the center of these designs, there is always a symbolic form that indicates the integrating principle. And this form in later symbology is the form of a god. It is a symbol of a deity. The deity becomes the superordinated principle to which everyone is ordinated, is coordinated. And this deity is incarnate in the king. This is very prominent in the pharaonic tradition of Egypt, but in early Mesopotamia it's present also. The king is a deity. Not only that, but everybody in his court is symbolically related to that king. Now, it was at this time, let us take the date about 3500 BC, that the five visible planets were discovered in the heavens. These five little points of light moving in mathematically calculable courses through the fixed stars. And it is at this time that the priest caste, discovering this, conceived the idea that there was a heavenly cosmic order which should be duplicated in the social order. And we have a pantomime, a courtly pantomime of the order of the heavens. It is at this time that the symbology of the crown, the solar crown, or the lunar crown with the horns of the moon come along. The king and court represent this heavenly order. Now, in the middle 20s, there was an extraordinary discovery made, which I'm sure a number of you have read about, by Sir Leonard Woolley in the old Sumerian city of Ur, from which Abraham is supposed to have come. He was digging within the temple compound of Ur, which is the old city of the moon god, and he came upon multiple graves, graves in which as many as 64 human beings had been buried together, all in courtly array. And they were not people in a disorderly fashion thrown into the grave and covered over. They were in rows without any signs of struggle. They were mostly court people. One of the most important graves is that of a woman who is called Shubad, who was buried beside a man who is thought to have been her husband, Abari. It was originally thought they were king and queen. They may have been. The queen's entire court was buried with her, And the king's entire court was buried with him under hers. She had a court of 25 people buried with her. She had been brought in a sledge that had been drawn by asses, and this entire court had been buried with her. Beneath it was the court of the man who was thought to have been her husband. You can't tell from just the names. And with him there were buried some 50 or 65 people. He had been brought in on a wagon with oxen. All of these were in the graves. Now, these people were in court attire. The girl harpist who had been playing the harp, her skeleton hands were still on the harp strings, or where the strings had been. And the harp itself was in the form of a bull's body. And the bull's head, a beautiful golden bull's head, had a lapis lazuli beard. This was a mythological bull. This is the bull whose lunar horns we see, the moon bull, who dies and is resurrected, dies and is resurrected. This is the god Tammuz of the old mythological days. Now, it is thought that this entire court had gone into the grave as a ritual act. This is only one instance. In every one of the ancient cultures, the Egyptian culture, the early Chinese, we have graves with as many as 800 people buried in them. And the dynasties, the pharaohs of the first Egyptian dynasties, had in fact two funereal estates, one in Abydos and one in Memphis. So you would have a country place and a city place with as many as 400 people buried with the king in each one of these. Let us ask, where is the individual in a situation of this sort? There is no such thing. There is only this great law, which in Egyptian was called Maat, in Babylonian, in Sumerian was called Mei, in Chinese is the Tao, in Sanskrit is Dharma. This is a cosmic law that comes from all eternity, permeates the world, and anyone who wishes to be a thing, who wishes really to be something, must live in terms of this cosmic law. And there is to be no individual choice whatsoever. There is no opportunity to think, what would I like to do? What would I like to be? Your birth determines exactly what you are to do. This basic ideal of what I shall now call dharma, of virtue, of a cosmic law to which the individual must submit if he is to be anything, is fundamental in the Orient to this day. And the individual who does not participate in that is said to be asat. He is nothing. He is no thing. Whereas the one who does participate in that is something, sat. The Sanskrit word that has been pronounced sati, where the wife follows her husband into the grave. This is simply the feminine form of the participle sat. She is something. She is a wife because she has fulfilled the wifely role. And when we look back at those graves in Ur, there was a wife. This whole court went following the husband in death. Not only that, but those early kings were themselves killed ritually. Every 6 years, every 8 years, every 12 years, in varying numbers according to the various traditions, the king and his court went into the ground to be dissolved and born again in the next court. It's a fantastic, noble, wonderful ideal, this archaic ideal of the individual who is nobody, but simply the incarnation of a vast, glorious law. Now, it is against that that the Occidental ideal of the individual must be measured. And if we look for a date when the first sign of the transformation comes along, we can take the date about 2500 BC, a little later than that, when the texts in the Mesopotamian area begin to distinguish between the man and the god. The king is no longer a God king. The king is the servant of the God. He is called the tenant farmer of the God. The city is the God's estate, and the king is the God's servant there. It is at this point that myths begin to come along of man created by the gods to be God's servant. Man is to be the servant of the God. He is not himself a manifestation of the divinity in any sense. God and creature are apart. He is the servant of the God and the God's slave. Now, I want to take a very interesting myth and indicate its appearance in India and in the West, and let you see from this how these two worldviews, the worldview of the individual who is no individual but participates in a divine essence, and the Western idea of the individual who is separated from the God, how they stand in contrast. To begin with, let me take the Indian myth. In one of the great Indian sacred writings, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which dates from about 700 BC, there is the story of the creation of the world. And it runs as follows. In the beginning, the world was only the self. The world was only the self. And the self said to itself, I am. And as soon as it said, I am, it had the concept I, aham in Sanskrit, ego. As soon as it thought I, it became afraid. Then it reasoned and thought, of whom should I be afraid, since there is no one but myself? By this reasoning, fear was eliminated. No sooner was fear eliminated than this being thought, I wish there were another. Now this being was as big as a man and woman embracing, and it split apart and became a man and woman. And the man embraced the woman and begot men. And the woman thought, how can he embrace me when I am of his substance? And she turned into a cow, and he turned into a bull and begot cattle. And this thing went right down the line to the ants. And so all beings were created, poured forth. The Sanskrit word is sushti, poured forth. Creation is a pouring forth of this original being who split in two and became the world. And he looked around and said, I verily am this. It is all I that has become the world. Now, do you remember the counterpart from Genesis? Do you remember a certain gentleman who was split in half? His name Adam, to wit, and what James Joyce calls the cutlet-sized consort, was drawn from his rib. Adam was split in half and became Adam and Eve, and we are all their progeny. But please notice, in this case, God split Adam apart. You have God and man. The God did not become creation. The God is apart from creation. Man and God are not the same. Creature and created are different from each other. These are two totally different interpretations of the same symbol, of the split being that became two and then became all things. Now from this, I want to point to the main ideal for the individual in the great traditions of the Orient. The main ideal is that you should realize that you are a manifestation of that being. That is what you are. It is to be a discovery, a recognition of identity. In the West, the main ideal is that you should discover a relationship to that being, not an identity. This is a quite different religious notion. Now let me go on. The great symbol for us of Oriental realization is the figure of the Buddha. The story of the Buddha's realization is extremely illuminating in its psychological nature. The Buddha was seeking to know what the truth of truths is. And after discussions with many sages and so forth, he finally rejects all that he has heard and goes himself to what is called the Tree of Illumination, the Bodhi tree, which is in the immovable spot in the middle of the world. There's a very nice story of his arrival at the Bodhi tree, and I will tell it briefly to ornament this occasion. The Buddha arrived at the great tree, and he stood at the south of it and faced south. And the southern part of the world tipped so that the edge touched hell, and the northern part tipped up so that it touched heaven. And the Buddha said, "This cannot be the immovable spot." And so he moved with his right arm to the tree around to the western side. And standing there, facing west, he noticed that the earth tipped down so that the west touched hell, and the east tipped up. He said, "This cannot be the immovable spot." Went to the north, same thing, went to the east, and it remained still. He therefore sat there, said, "This is the immovable spot where all of the Buddhas have found enlightenment." Please notice, all of the Buddhas. He is simply doing what the predecessors of his enterprise had done. Then he settled himself there, and as he was seated, the very being who, in the first story that I had told, said Ahang, named the creator of the world, came against the Buddha. The one who had said, "I." The one who then had said, "I am afraid." The one who then had said, "I desire." "I" says two things. It says, "I fear" and "I desire." This is the old Oriental concept.